Thank you, Peter, for the introduction, and certainly it's good to be here at Cedar. Certainly we as a company believe that Cedar has an important role in encouraging discussion and independent analysis and advice to government, so we're certainly very happy to support Cedar. Today I thought I'd really mainly talk about the journey of CSL and some of the things that we've done and some of the issues that we've come across, and probably finish on some of the directional matters for both us as a company, but also, I guess, some of the challenges for the broader pharmaceutical industry here in Australia, as there's certainly significant change occurring. But I guess turning back to CSL, certainly, as Peter mentioned, we've had a terrific journey over a number of years to migrate from what we were to where we are today. And I think some of the consistent principles that we've tried to adhere to is that we're very much stuck to internal capabilities. And I think that that's what attracted me to the job at CSL in 1989. I saw that it was an organisation with skills and promise. But really, it struggled under public ownership with the complexity of public ownership, with the government being not only the shareholder but also our regulator, as well as our key customer. It created an environment where the organisation struggled to prosper, and clearly in an Australian market where it's difficult to justify scaled investment in research and development and also in manufacturing. So the problem for the organisation was when it celebrated its 80 years of history, it saw that its Parkville site was more a museum piece than a modern organisation, because of lack of government support for capital expenditure, fragmented R&D investment. And in fact, when I look back at the organisation in 1989, that when I started, I looked at the revenues, and the revenues at that time was about $80 million. Half the revenues came from penicillin and insulin. We don't do those things anymore. We found we had no future in penicillins. We'd lost our future in penicillin through innovation from Smith Kline and other companies. Insulin, the organisation was very strong in insulin at the time, but innovation from Novo Nordisk internationally meant that we couldn't compete. And so what we really had was a declining revenue base. We had an asset base that was struggling to find new technologies to invest in, and we became really a technologically dependent company. And it seems to me that's the industrial challenge for many Australian companies, whether they be subsidiaries of multinational parents or Australian-owned companies. We have a tendency to create technologically dependent companies on others, and so therefore we're fairly good at applying the technology, but we struggle actually with the notion that we want to be innovative and actually take things internationally ourselves. In any event, we persuaded, certainly with the great assistance of the late John Button, who was a great friend and mentor to me, that the company CSL could have a future. And the first thing we needed to do was actually have independence of government. So we did publicly list in 1994. I'd have to say the IPO wasn't easy to get away. CSL tended to do a lot of quirky things that not many people understood much about. We also, you know, people had seen many Australian companies not succeed either through innovation or, more importantly, through internationalisation. And in fact, it's still the case today that we have many cynical shareholders, or I would now say nowadays ex-shareholders, who felt that internationalisation was in fact a strategy of peril for all Australian companies. And in fact, the view is that we should just invest in the local market and keep trying to grow that way. But we took a different view. We actually believed in the skills of the company, and we tried to identify some niches in which we could prosper. And I'd have to say we took a very disciplined and graduated approach to our internationalisation. So, and one of the fundamentals I think that CSL did was not only did we understand technically the markets in which we operated, but we tried very hard to economically understand the global pressures of those markets and try and chart a path for us to be successful in those markets. And so that created different strategies for each of our activities. certainly in plasma therapeutics, which when I joined the company, our revenues in plasma proteins were $30 million, and this year they're going to be $3 billion. So we're selling 100 times more now plasma proteins. And I'd have to say that we had expertise in the sector, and we were encouraged, in fact, by the fact that internationally the view was that it was a somewhat mature, if not aging, sector, and therefore many of our international competitors were disinvesting in the sector, and that provided, in our view, opportunity for us. So we focused very carefully on the niche in which we felt we could create value, in which we could prosper, and then we could try and create a global footprint that we've continued on. We actually tried that same strategy with two other divisions that we did succeed in, but we ultimately exited, which I'll comment on briefly. We had, at the time, an animal health division that we had historically done well in Australia in animal health. You know, not many people, but a lot of sheep and cattle and a few cats and dogs. And, you know, CSL, the old Orange Pack, used to be well known on, any of you in the farming industry would know, we did a good job providing the Australian community with a range of products. And the Aussie farmer's got to be the toughest customer in the world. You know, you always knew you had to compete with a bullet in those days. You know, everything had to be cheap because, you know, vaccines is a prevention, and if the price went down, you know, that'd be not very good for the animal. But in any event, we were a very cost-effective, scaled manufacturer, and we tried to internationalise. We took their business to New Zealand. We made a small acquisition. We made another small acquisition in the US, and we grew a global capability, and we created value in that business. But when we looked at the scale necessary to be truly globally competitive in an end-game consolidation that really occurs in all industries, we took the opportunity to really maximise the value of that company through an exit strategy. So having taken a small business that only did about, in Australia, $8 to $10 million of revenue, we spent $3 million in New Zealand and $6 million in the States. So we had, you know, very minor investment. We sold it for $264 million. So we were not unhappy with the result. It's just that at the end of the day, there are times to invest and there are times to exit. And we have always do a very detailed analysis of marketplaces to try and understand where we are placed, where we could invest, and when we should also exit. And similarly, we did extremely well in another business unit called CSL Cell Culture. It's a provider to the biotech industry. We again took it was a very small business. It was a $3 million business when we were headed here in Australia. We spent $20 million in the US, and we built that business to become arguably the most highest quality cell culture company in the industry. But we felt the business had peaked, and we exited that 3 or 4 years ago for $364 million US and a $250 million US profit, which was quite pleasing to our shareholders as well. But we reinvested those funds in our successful efforts in plasma, and I think that certainly the notion that we believe in strongly is not only have a detailed understanding of our competencies, have a thorough understanding of the commercial marketplace, but also understand when to hold, when to buy, and when to sell. And I think that that's something that as a company we try very much to do. Of course, we continue to do national interest products, you know, anti-venoms, Q-vaccine, other activities, and we'll certainly continue to do that. But very much we've taken what was a very small, thin, but broad-based company, and certainly made it very strong and very narrow internationally. And I really can't speak more highly of the fact that our success, in my view, is significantly contributed by having a clear strategy well matched, I guess, to the economics of the marketplace. One of the other realities that we understand very clearly is, and even though I know the US has its challenges today, you can't succeed in our industry without having a significant US presence. And so in every business we've operated in, we've tried very hard to quite rapidly create a successful US presence. And certainly we've seen Cochlear and ResMed, you know, with similar strategies, because it is the world's most important healthcare market. Certainly when we understood important matters of global reach and scale, we carefully analysed an organic growth strategy versus an acquisition strategy and quickly came to the conclusion that certainly in the sectors in we operated, acquisition was a superior strategy for our shareholders, was lower risk if one had the technical expertise to do proper due diligence, integrate superbly, and of course buying well is very fundamental. And I think we've also taken a view that we're very patient as a company. The market always gets very excited. Are we going to buy things? Are we going to sell things? Well, I don't know. It depends. It depends on the opportunity. And I think you always have to take that view. You shouldn't over-articulate your strategy, in my view, because you get narrowed into a position. And similarly, if you have the market getting excited about things you may or may not do, it, in my view, it puts undue pressure on the company. So one of the benefits, Peter, of being an 18-year CEO is I'm quite patient about matters. We can take our time. We have a coherent strategy. And I think that we're trying to execute on that. And certainly the lessons of the three major plasma acquisitions we made in CSL, in ZLB in Switzerland, NABI, the plasma centre, and then Aventis Behring, is that we fundamentally buy well. You make most money in acquisitions in the purchase price. We integrated quickly. If we haven't done it in the first 90 days, then, in my view, you're not going to get it done. So we absolutely integrate quickly or ruthlessly, depending which way you look at it. From our perspective, it's quick. And certainly we have the skilled people, and many of them are Australians who've come up in our business here, who really execute flawlessly in what they do. And they're really wonderful people, and we do flawlessly execute. I guess as we've now grown our global platform, we've subtly amended our strategy. And again, what we've decided with our flu vaccine business, which is another niche that we've been providing the Australian market with flu for decades, is that it was not a business in of itself that you could scale and grow internationally without the complementary commercial assets internationally. So again, we have taken the view that now that we have a fully scaled global operation, we sell in 30 countries, I think, near enough, all the major Western economies, we can then grow our complementary assets, like our flu vaccine manufacturing capability here in Australia, and we did have support from the Victorian government, which, John, thank you for that many years ago, to try and help us grow that capability and then achieve registration in the all-important US and European markets, and then cost-effectively and seamlessly commercialise that product through the existing framework that we have. So again, some assets you can achieve scale directly. You can achieve it through M&A. Certainly with our flu vaccine, we took the view that we needed the economies of scale from a commercial perspective, and by having our complementary assets inside CSL Behring, we could then leverage that opportunity. And the final arm of the success of CSL is really the reason why most of us, to be honest, get out of bed in the morning, and that's really what we do from an R&D and innovation perspective. Because fundamentally, we love making new medicines. I mean, that's sort of why we come to work. I mean, we do all the other stuff, and the shareholders are great some of the time, and the media sort of write their stories, fine, you know. But the reality is that we have a group of really talented people who really believe in the dream of new medicines and trying to move the dial as a company. But again, I think we've been very realistic about our approach to that strategy. We recognised, you know, many years ago that when we were a small company, we had no opportunity of being fully vertically integrated and trying to commercialise everything ourselves. So we've tried to very logically move up the value chain as we mature as a company. So if I look back to early 90s when we were quite a small company, and we had a tremendous relationship with Merck, that we then licensed them the work that we had supported with Professor Ian Fraser in the field of HPV. It ultimately, some, you know, 15 or 16 years later, comes through with Gardasil, which is fantastic for all of us. And it's I mean, the commercial success is great, but again, believe it or not, it's not why we do what we do. We do it because we actually have a group of people who believe in the hope of new medicines and believe that from our Australian base, we can nurture and create opportunities that are truly globally competitive and one in which we can make a difference. And from an original budget of, you know, a few million dollars, this year's our R&D budget, I think last year's finishing 220 million. This year will be 250 million. I mean, clearly I'd love the budget to be 500 million. And I think within the next 5 years there's a chance of that. And I think that's the sort of infrastructure and capability you really need to have in a scaled sense to truly be competitive and actually create success in an annuity sense. And so we're certainly very, very committed to that. I'd have to say, you know, I've had the good fortune of having a very supportive board. You know, things haven't always been easy at the company in the sense that some of the acquisitions, you know, for a year or two looked expensive or may have not been the right strategic move, but they were very supportive, and I think we've worked hard to ensure that we've made a success of all our acquisitions, and the market has been very, very supportive. So it's sort of another observation that M&A is hard, but it's also hard because it's never always going to look to be a brilliant move. All industries go through a cycle. And the reality is what looks a brilliant, prescient move, you know, in 2 years' time may not look so clever in 4 years' time. But you have to adapt, you have to use the scale, and you have to move forward. And I think that I think we've tried very hard to do that. And as I said, I've had a very supportive board and investor base. But arguably the most important thing I've had is a great management team. Many of them are people who've grown up with us, been educated with us, and really I'm a great believer in their skill base. And certainly I think that that's the fundamental reason why we can continue to succeed, I believe, is that we're great believers in universities and education. We're great believers in academic collaborations. I think we've got good values as a company. I think we treat each other well as people inside the company. And so therefore people are very confident of how we're going to behave even in circumstances that may be stressful. And I think that that's something that we take internationally to all the companies that we own and work with. Turning to the pharmaceutical industry here in Australia, one of the hats I've accepted is from Senator Carr to report to him, and I've agreed to chair the Pharmaceutical Industry Strategy Group to have a look at where is Australia heading from a pharmaceutical industry perspective, because we've had a number of government programs. And I'd have to say the evidence is really a bit mixed as to whether or not it's been highly successful, some of those plans, and whether it's really provided a net economic and social gain. I mean, I'd have to say I think CSL's been a pretty good gain for Australia, but the rest of the rest of the challenges are clear, and I thought I'd share some of them with you. We conducted a SWOT analysis to understand again, you know, how is the industry stand. And look, I'd have to say probably the two most important things we rely upon as an industry is the early stage biotech, and the quality of our universities and our research institutes is the only way we can be competitive. So we have to continue to nurture, invest, and be involved in academic and follow-on science. The second thing I'd have to say is we have a good healthcare system in Australia, and again, that provides a good environment for the regulatory environment, clinical trial development, and certainly from Gardasil's perspective as an example, the rapid rollout of Gardasil to young women has been, in my view, a fantastic achievement by all state governments, supported by the federal government, and it really shows Australia's healthcare system in its best light. The challenge for Australia, though, is very real moving forward. I think, so as saying, the strengths are in our science and the early part of the academic environment, but the challenge is that most pharmaceutical companies site their manufacturing sites based on taxation, not based on the market. So we have a declining manufacturing base here in Australia for the pharmaceutical industry. In fact, I think only 9 companies now out of the 100 or so who operate here actually manufacture in this country. And we probably represent, you know, a big piece of the value adding and continuing capital expenditure. Even for us, there's no doubt, we have to do a lot of final stage biotech work near our markets, Europe and North America. And I think that it's a challenge for Australia to attract that capability because we often lack the critical mass in certain areas to truly be competitive. And my international colleagues, and again, I don't blame them for this, their strategy is really to pick the eyes out of the Australian academic environment. They identify a great piece of science, whether it be Monash or Melbourne or elsewhere, and they take it back to head office. I mean, that's the ugly truth of the pharmaceutical industry. It's very hard to build an industry based on these international companies, hoping that they'll collaborate in an expanded way with academic colleagues in Australia. Evidence would suggest that's an unlikely strategy. We've had some great successes. I think Cochlear, ResMed and ourselves have done, you know, really well. We just don't have enough of us. That's, unfortunately, if you look at the balance of trade in sort of sophisticated healthcare products, if you look at the level of value adding in this country, if you look at employment, you know, we're not really moving the dial. And I think one of the challenges for me, reporting back to Senator Carr, will be what realistically we could do to move the dial in such a difficult environment. Because the gorillas of the industry, I mean, these are the really big guys. We're a mid-sized company in the pharma world, but the big guys, they're under huge pressure nowadays. They have many of their drugs going off patent shortly, so they have huge generic competition. They're rationalising their supply chain internationally. Their R&D productivity has declined dramatically, so throwing more money at R&D hasn't actually necessarily produced more products. And more they're concentrating, therefore, their R&D closer and closer to head office. So it's actually more difficult for Australia to actually argue that it would be sensible to create a node of excellence here in inflammation or oncology. So it's a significant challenge for those companies because some of you may not be aware, but the total shareholder return for the pharmaceutical industry, the big guys, the last 7 years, is 0%. They've returned nothing to shareholders. They've got Pfizer and GSK, the share prices over 7 years have declined. They haven't gone up. So many of these companies are in extreme pressure and they're rationalising what they see as peripheral activities, and Australia, unfortunately, is a peripheral activity for many companies. So we're working hard at the PISG. I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that. Unfortunately, I don't think I have a magic wand to deal with all those challenges for Senator Carr, but I do think most of the answer for the success of Australia moving forward in this world will, as always, go back to, in my view, excellent science, great academic groups, sensible collaborations with commercial entities, a few scaled critical mass organisations who actually have development capabilities, and I think we need to create a few more of those. And that we have to continue to accept the lead times are very long for new medicine, and to continue to request of government support for innovation, because ultimately, as good as the mineral industry is, I'm not sure we can continue relying on digging stuff out of the ground. That we do need to accept that we have to actually create some organisations that are developing new medicines, doing new things, and creating value for Australia, social benefit and value, and clearly economic value for shareholders. So thank you, Peter. I'm happy to be here and happy to take questions. Thank you.